Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Today, we're immersing ourselves in a tradition that's both, you know, ancient and really fiercely relevant, Confucianism.
Yeah, it's huge. And when we talk about Eastern philosophy, this is so foundational.
Absolutely. But it often gets kind of boxed away, doesn't it? Like it's just rigid, archaic rules.
That's the exact misconception we really want to tackle today. Our guide here is Daniel K. Gardner. And through his books like Confucianism, a living tradition, he argues pretty forcefully, actually, that this is anything but some dusty relic.
Okay.
It's a dynamic, evolving, and profoundly humanistic conversation about how we can live well together.
And that's really our mission in this deep dive, isn't it? To get past that caricature of like strict hierarchy and see the ethical engine that's been driving East Asian societies for centuries.
Yeah. And why does this matter now? Well, because if you want to understand, say, modern Chinese leadership philosophy or the huge emphasis on education and relationships in South Korea or Japan, you really need to understand where the roots are.
Definitely.
The questions Confucius was asking back then about ethical governance, social cohesion, these are still massive global challenges today.
Couldn't agree more. And to guide us through this pretty complex history, we've got Daniel K. Gardner. He's a distinguished professor, Chinese history and philosophy at Smith College.
Right.
Got his PhD from Harvard, and he spent, well, over three decades really digging into these texts.
That kind of deep academic immersion is so crucial, isn't it? He's not just, you know, summarizing the history. He's really lived in the philosophical nuances.
Yeah.
Especially his work on Neo-Confucianism. I know he did that acclaimed translation of Zhu Xi's Learning to Be a Sage.
That's right. And what makes his perspective, I think, so valuable is that he operates with this kind of dual expertise. He's a historian, meticulously tracing the chronology. But he's also a philosopher, analyzing its coherence, its strengths, and importantly, its contemporary relevance.
So he bridges the gap.
Exactly. It lets him rigorously correct those common Western misunderstandings, like thinking it's just a state religion instead of a moral project, while still keeping that scholarly depth.
Okay, so let's get to the core, the central premise of Gardner's work.
Mm.
If we really boil down this vast history of Confucianism, what's the big question it's trying to answer?
Well, fundamentally, it's wrestling with this massive, enduring question. How can we live together to create a harmonious, just, and flourishing social and political order?
A small question, then.
Ah, yeah, just a small one. And the core philosophical insight is that the solution is fundamentally this-worldly.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Well, forget the idea of securing, like, otherworldly salvation or something. The goal is building a moral, ordered society right here on Earth, right now. And the way to do that, the mechanism, is the transformative power of self-cultivation. It starts with the individual. You improve the individual, morally transform them, and the society follows.
That's fascinating. So the book itself, it sounds really comprehensive. It outlines the tradition's incredible resilience, right?
Totally. It takes you on this journey, starts with Confucius responding to the chaos of the late Zhou dynasty, moves through the Han and Song revival's New Confucianism, which we'll definitely get into, and even tracks its suppression during the Cultural Revolution, and then its surprising resurgence today in the 21st century.
Wow. So this tradition, it just refuses to stay buried.
It adapts. It has to adapt or it dies, right?
Yeah.
And Confucianism is, well, it's a master adapter.
Okay. Let's jump into some of those core concepts then, because understanding the historical context feels really key here. Confucius was living during the Warring States period, what, 770 to 476 BCE?
Yeah, a time of incredible turmoil. Societies were literally tearing themselves apart. So his vision wasn't just abstract philosophy. It was a practical ethical blueprint for trying to stabilize everything.
And what was the goal of that blueprint?
Well, the ultimate goal, the ultimate virtue, is defined as ren. It's often translated as humaneness, benevolence, compassion. It's the quality of being fully and ethically human.
Okay, so ren is like the internal ethical compass. But how do you express that? Is it just, you know, wishing to be good?
Ha, no, not quite. And that's where the second core concept comes in, lai. This is usually translated as ritual propriety or social convention.
Rituals, like ceremonies.
Yes, but much broader than that. Lai is the external structure, the kind of rules of engagement for society. Gardner explains it beautifully. He says lai is the grammar for expressing ren.
Ah, okay. Grammar.
Yeah. So if ren is the feeling of compassion, lai is knowing the proper etiquette for, say, a funeral or a business meeting, or how to interact respectfully with your parents. In the Confucian view, ethics aren't just ideas, they're habits. And habits are formed by ritual structure.
That makes sense. So you need both the inner feeling and the outer action.
Precisely. And if you master both the internal ethics of ren and the external propriety of lai, you become the moral ideal, the yunzi, the exemplary person, or sometimes translated as gentleman.
And the really revolutionary part, you mentioned this earlier, was that Confucius argued moral worth, achieved through relentless learning and self-cultivation, qualified you for leadership, not noble birth.
Exactly. He basically democratized excellence, which was huge at the time.
But I bet that idea didn't go unchallenged.
Oh, absolutely not. Which actually proves the dynamism of the tradition right from the start. And that brings us to the first great philosophical debate within Confucianism, Mencius versus Zunzi.
Okay, Mencius and Zunzi.
They both agreed the goal was the Jinzi, the exemplary person. But they profoundly disagreed on the starting point. Human nature.
Ah, the classic debate. So what did Mencius think?
Mencius was the idealist. He argued human nature is inherently good. We have these innate sprouts, he called them, of compassion, righteousness, propriety, and wisdom.
Sprouts, like little seeds of goodness.
Kind of. His famous example is seeing a child about to fall into a well. Your immediate spontaneous impulse isn't calculation, it's alarm and compassion you want to save them. That proves, for Mencius, this inherent goodness. So education is basically just watering the garden, nurturing those sprouts.
Okay, that's quite optimistic. What about Zunzi?
Zunzi was the great pragmatist, maybe even a bit of a pessimist, some might say. He argued human nature is, well, maybe not evil, but certainly unruly, driven by innate, selfish desires that naturally lead to conflict if left unchecked.
So the opposite of Mencius.
Pretty much. For Zunzi, goodness isn't natural. It's an artificial human achievement. It requires strenuous effort, constant shaping.
How do you achieve that shaping, then?
Through rigorous adherence to Li, those rituals and social conventions, and crucially, the guidance of a teacher. He used the analogy of straightening crooked wood. You need external force and structure to make it straight.
Hmm. So if Zunzi is right, and goodness requires all this strenuous effort, this external shaping, doesn't that kind of lean towards, I don't know, an authoritarian system? Mm-hmm. How does that forceful shaping lead to genuine humaneness, to ren?
That's a really good question, and it points to the brilliance of how the tradition managed to synthesize these views. Because here's the thing. Both Mencius and Zunzi, despite their completely opposite starting points about human nature, they agreed on one absolute necessity, relentless self-cultivation and learning. Whether you believe you're nurturing innate goodness like Mencius or fighting innate selfishness like Zunzi, the path to becoming a Jinzi and creating social order involves constant effort, moral discipline, and education.
So the how was similar, even if the why was different.
Exactly. The system demanded commitment and active participation, not just passive belief. And this kind of flexibility and focus on practice is probably why the tradition managed to survive and adapt.
Which leads us to how it eventually shifted into state orthodoxy, right, under the Han Dynasty.
Precisely. That transition was largely engineered by a figure named Dong Zongshu. He was instrumental in institutionalizing the philosophy.
What did he do? How did he manage that?
Dong was a master synthesizer. He took the practical social ethics of Confucianism and cleverly wove them together with popular cosmological beliefs of the time, things like yin-yang theory and the five phases or five elements.
Oh, wow. So mixing philosophy with cosmology.
Yes. He created this grand, all-encompassing ideology that the imperial state could actually use. It provided a cosmic justification for social order.
And how did the emperor fit into this grand scheme?
This synthesis elevated the emperor to become the crucial moral link between heaven, earth, and humanity. He became the son of heaven.
The son of heaven.
And the huge consequence of this was the concept of the mandate of heaven. It became a powerful framework for both legitimizing the emperor's political power and for morally criticizing it.
How did it work for criticism?
Well, the idea was if the emperor and his government were corrupt or incompetent, the cosmic order would be disrupted, leading to natural disasters like floods or famines. These were seen as signs that heaven was displeased.
So it gave scholars and officials a kind of leverage.
Exactly. A moral basis to criticize the ruler and demand reform, grounded in this cosmic framework. And practically, this synthesis led directly to the creation and entrenchment of the civil service examination system.
Based on the Confucian classics.
Absolutely.
Right?
You had to master Confucian texts and principles to become a government official. This cemented the philosophy right into the heart of the Chinese bureaucracy for, well, nearly two millennia.
Incredible staying power. But history keeps throwing curveballs, doesn't it?
Mm.
You mentioned the later rise of other major traditions like Buddhism and Taoism.
Right. And these traditions posed a significant intellectual challenge because they offered really sophisticated metaphysical frameworks, theories about the ultimate nature of reality, the cosmos, the soul, things that classical Confucianism hadn't focused on quite as much.
So Confucianism had to evolve again.
It did. It had to develop its own robust metaphysics to compete intellectually and spiritually. And this leads us to the Great Song Dynasty revival known as Neo-Confucianism.
And the key figure here is Zhu Xi.
Zhu Xi is the towering figure, yes. He undertook this massive task of creating a comprehensive metaphysical framework for Confucianism. And this is where, as Gardner carefully explains, we encounter a potential point of confusion. The two Lis.
Okay, right. We talked about Li meaning ritual or propriety earlier.
Exactly. That's the Li related to social conduct. But Zhu Xi needed a term for the ultimate principle or pattern underlying all of reality. And he used a word with the same sound, but a different character and meaning, Li, which means principle.
Oh, okay. Same sound, different concept, like read and read in English.
Precisely. Think of Zhu Xi's Li principle as the underlying perfect blueprint or pattern of the cosmos and everything within it, including, crucially, our own inherent human nature. He believed our fundamental nature is this perfect principle.
Okay, so our core nature is this perfect Li principle. What else is there?
He paired that concept with qi, often translated as vital force or material force or ether. Qi is the physical stuff, the energy that makes up everything tangible in the universe, including our bodies and minds.
So we have the perfect principle, Li, and the physical stuff, qi. How do they relate?
This is the genius of Zhu Xi's system for explaining moral failure. Our fundamental nature, our Li principle, is inherently good and perfect. However, our physical embodiment, our qi, can be impure or turbid.
Like cloudy.
Exactly. Think of a perfectly clear mirror, Li, that gets covered in dust, qi. The mirror itself isn't flawed, but the dust obstructs its ability to reflect clearly. Our turbid qi obstructs our access to our own perfect, good nature.
Yep. So that's why we fail morally sometimes. Our qi is cloudy.
That's the Neo-Confucian explanation. It explains that gap between knowing what's right and actually doing it. The path to sagehood, therefore, isn't about acquiring goodness from outside, but about diligently clearing away the turbidity of our qi through study, reflection, and ethical practice so our inherent Li can shine through.
Wow, that's actually a really powerful psychological framework, isn't it? It acknowledges the struggle.
It really is. It gives a reason for moral effort.
Okay, this is a lot to absorb. Let's try to distill this down into some of the key themes that Gardner really wants us to take away from this whole tradition. What's the first big one?
I'd say number one has to be the primacy of moral cultivation. This is the absolute heartbeat of the entire tradition, from Confucius to Zhu Xi and beyond.
It's all about self-improvement.
Fundamentally, yes. It's deeply concerned with transforming individuals through ethical development. And crucially, it provides practical methods for doing that reflection, study, ritual practice. It moves ethics out of the realm of abstract ideals and into the daily practical struggle for developing character.
Okay, moral cultivation first. What's second?
Second, I'd highlight the relational self. This is a big contrast to a lot of Western thought. In Confucianism, you aren't primarily an autonomous, isolated individual.
You're defined by your connections.
Exactly. Your identity and your ethical obligations are defined within your specific relationships. Parent-child, ruler-subject, husband-wife, older-younger sibling, friend-friend. These are the famous five relationships. Social harmony doesn't come from individuals pursuing their own rights, but from people navigating these specific reciprocal bonds with ren, humaneness, and li, propriety.
That makes sense. Your duties change depending on who you're dealing with. What's a third key theme?
Third, definitely the dynamic nature of tradition itself. Gardner really emphasizes this. Confucianism survived for millennia not because it was static, but precisely because it adapted.
Like the Mencius-Sunzi debate, or the Neo-Confucian synthesis with Zhu Xi.
Exactly. It constantly reinterpreted its core principles to address new historical circumstances, new intellectual challenges, contemporary crises. It wasn't about just preserving ancient practices unchanged. It was about keeping the core ethical project alive and relevant.
Okay, and one more. Maybe the link between the personal and the political.
Yes, absolutely. The fourth would be the intertwining of ethics and politics. This is crucial. Political legitimacy, in the Confucian view, rests fundamentally on the moral character of the leader.
It's about DA, right? Virtuous power.
Precisely. The ruler must lead by virtuous example, inspiring the people, not by coercion or force alone. This provides a powerful moral check on political power, yeah. One that's theoretically independent of military might or wealth. The ruler has to be good, or at least appear to be, to maintain legitimacy.
These themes really show the depth and practicality. And you mentioned the texts are full of memorable wisdom, too.
Oh, absolutely. They're not just dense philosophy. They're packed with...
Let's maybe highlight a few of those notable quotes or core ideas. I know one that always struck me relates to motivation. The gentleman understands what is right. The small person understands what is profitable.
Ah, yes. That's a classic from the Analects. It's timeless, isn't it? It forces you to really examine your own decision-making process.
Yeah, it cuts deep.
Are you acting based on you righteousness, moral principle, or are you just focused on self-interest, on the immediate profit or advantage? It's such a crucial distinction, whether you're talking business, politics, or just personal life.
Definitely. What's another key one? Maybe about learning.
There's that great line, learning without thinking is useless. Thinking without learning is dangerous.
Explain that one.
It perfectly captures this balanced approach to education and self-cultivation that's so central. It warns against two pitfalls, two kinds of ignorance, really. On one hand, just passively absorbing information without critically reflecting on it, without internalizing it, that's useless learning, mindless memorization. But on the other hand, just speculating or having opinions without grounding them in actual study and knowledge that's dangerous. It leads to error and potentially harmful actions.
So you need both study and reflection working together.
Exactly. Integration is key.
And there's the universally relatable one, isn't there? The Confucian golden rule.
Right. Do not impose on others what you do not wish for yourself.
Simple, but profound.
It really is. It's the principle of Shu, or reciprocity. It grounds ethics firmly in empathy and imagination. It demands that you actively put yourself in the other person's shoes, consider their feelings and desires before you act.
We should probably also include one that speaks directly to that political dimension we discussed.
Good idea. There's a very clear one about governance. If you would govern a state of 1,000 chariots, you must pay strict attention to business, be true to your word, be economical in expenditure, and love the people.
Well, that packs a lot in.
It really does. It encapsulates that integration we talked about. Practical competence, strict attention to business, personal integrity, be true to your word, be economical, and genuine moral care. Love the people. For Confucius, good governance requires all three. Character is inseparable from competence.
Okay, so we've explored the history, the concepts, the themes, the wisdom. How can someone listening to this actually apply some of this ancient framework today? Let's talk real-life applications.
Yeah, that's the important question. For personal development, I think Gardner's work really pushes us towards embracing that idea of continuous self-cultivation.
What does that look like in practice?
Well, it could mean implementing specific practices, like setting aside time for daily reflection on your actions and motives, or consciously trying to view challenges, maybe setbacks at work or in relationships, not just as failures, but as opportunities for moral growth, for strengthening your character. It's an alternative to striving for some impossible perfection or just giving in to moral relativism.
I like that. Viewing challenges as growth opportunities. What about in leadership or management?
There, the key insight is applying that principle of leading by moral example. If you're a leader and you want your team or subordinates to prioritize integrity, collaboration, long-term vision, well, you have to embody those qualities yourself, consistently.
Walk the talk.
Exactly. In the Confucian view, authority ultimately rests on moral credibility, not just your job title or power. You have to earn that trust through your actions and character. It also means taking responsibility for the moral and professional development of those under you.
That feels very relevant today. How about education?
Confucianism offers a real challenge to modern education systems that often focus heavily on just technical skills or knowledge transmission.
Right, preparing people just for jobs.
Yeah. The Confucian insight is that education should fundamentally integrate character formation with intellectual learning. The goal should be to develop the whole person ethically responsible citizens, not just skilled technicians. How do we teach ethics alongside engineering or literature?
That's a big question for educators. And finally, maybe conflict resolution.
The emphasis on harmony and reciprocity, Shu, offers a different approach. Instead of focusing purely on blame, punishment, or achieving outright victory in a dispute, the focus shifts towards finding solutions that actually restore the relationship, address the underlying concerns that caused the conflict, and reestablish a sense of balance and mutual respect. It's about fixing the broken bond, not just winning the argument.
That requires a lot more empathy and effort, I suppose.
It definitely does.
Okay, this has been a really rich deep dive. As we wrap up, what's the one thing that stands out most for you? Maybe something surprising or that you particularly appreciated from Gardner's perspective?
For me, I think it's the profound, almost relentless humanism of the philosophy. There's this deep conviction that we as human beings have the capacity to create a better, more moral, more harmonious society right here and now.
Not waiting for divine intervention.
Exactly. It's achieved through our own effort, our own internal discipline, our own commitment to relating to each other ethically. It puts the responsibility squarely on us. I find that incredibly empowering, actually.
Yeah, I get that. For me, I think the final lesson, or maybe realization, is just how necessary this kind of focus on moral development feels for tackling our contemporary global challenges.
How so?
Well, Confucianism seems to offer this nuanced path. It values social harmony and ethical leadership, which we desperately need, but it does so without falling into the trap of either, you know, unchecked hyper-individualism on one side or rigid top-down authoritarianism on the other.
It's seeking a balance.
Exactly. And that core idea you mentioned, that profound social change begins with individual self-transformation. That's the real challenge, isn't it? It forces us to take responsibility for our own moral growth, recognizing that it's completely inseparable from our responsibilities to the people and the world around us.
Well said. It's a demanding philosophy, but maybe one we need.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.